This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey everyone, just wanted to take a moment to tell you a little bit about our new partner, artandobject.com. Artandobject.com is a great new site that provides up-to-date information about art, art history, and what is happening in the art world. It's a great resource that features current exhibitions all around the world and showcases arts-related content, like podcasts. Be sure to check it out at www.artandobject.com. I also wanted to quickly thank all of our patrons for making the Art History Babes possible, and a special thank you to our producer-level patrons Sarah Sawatchka-Dalton and Anna Marie Piccioni. If you would like to learn how to become a patron, head on over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes and enjoy the show.
From Cabernet to Moment,
welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Jen.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Jenny, and we are the Art History Babes.
We're here. It's our Halloween episode.
No, Corey.
Oh, holiday. I meant holiday, not Halloween.
Halloween part two.
I live a 24/7, 365 Halloween lifestyle. So.
Yep, that was a glimpse.
Yeah, the Halloween vlog, that was a lot of fun to put together. I'm just, like, glad we have that for our own, like, keepsake memory.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, man. I was listening to our two-parter, Art and Murder, at work, and I was really afraid about, like, peeing my pants. I was laughing so hard. And I looked like an idiot because I'm just trying to work and I'm laughing and no one knows what the hell I'm laughing about. And I was, oh man, it was just too funny. That was a great two-parter.
Yeah, that was a great time. That was a fun one for sure.
Oh man.
And now it's another holiday season.
And we're not all together on the holidays this year, but we have a really fun weekend planned for end of January. Wow, we're all wrong about our dates and times. It's not even November anymore.
The funny part is when it first came up, remember, you thought it was this month. Like, that is literally when you thought it was originally.
I did. I was like, you guys, I can't do this.
Like, I can't go to LA next week.
I'm not made of money.
Yeah, we're going to LA the end of January, and we're going to participate in the LA Art Fair. So all of you LA listeners down there, like, we'll have more information and stuff for you guys, but like, hopefully we can like meet up with some of y'all and do fun art things.
Yeah. Word. It's going to be so fun. I've never been to LA just like as an adult.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So here we go.
It'll be really cool.
There's things to do. Yeah. There are things to do down there.
There are things to do. There,
you know? Yeah, that's going to be really cool. And, like, I'm going to Art Basel. Oh, someone's knocking on the walls.
They're hammering.
Is it a spirit?
No, it's is it a spirit? It's literally probably my neighbor just doing some tweaker craft.
Cool.
Tweaker craft?
What is your craft?
I don't know.
What are tweakers?
I don't know.
But you know how, like, people on meth just, like, are always working on a project?
Wait, future episode.
Yes. The craft of tweaking. Tweaking as craft.
You really need to give a platform to the much unrecognized tweaker craft movement.
I do want to check and see what the hell this guy's doing.
Yeah, so we're all going to be together in January for the LA Art Fair. But yeah, right now I'm in the Midwest and it's very like holiday season-y here. We got like a couple inches of snow yesterday.
Ooh, that's so nice.
Yeah, snow, and I'm drinking hot chocolate, and, you know.
Wow.
We're drinking mimosas.
Mimosas and white wine in California.
California.
I'm just some California bitch.
And the sun is out today. It's actually really nice out.
Yeah, but the smoke has dissipated.
Oh, thank goodness.
We had some rain. Yeah, so our listeners who are not in California, rest assured.
We were on fire. I don't know if you knew.
We were on fire. We're okay now for the most part. I mean, none of us lost any family or property in the campfire.
But a lot of people did.
Yeah, so that's really unfortunate. So if you want to help out, making direct donations to the groups that are out there helping out is a good idea. If you are tempted to donate, please donate money to people like the Red Cross. A lot of people want to donate things like canned food items and blankets and things like that, which is fine, but you know, these groups that are specially equipped to handle these disasters can stretch your dollar a lot more than, say, if you go out and buy things to donate. So keep that in mind.
Also, there are a lot of like independent artists doing cool things and donating the
prints and stuff to like the fire department.
It's very nice.
Get people some Christmas gifts that also help.
I know. And that's like another thing too is just, I mean, I feel so lucky that we're sitting here, we're all okay and you know, the holidays are coming up and it's time to be a family and friends and whatnot. And just knowing that so many people were left homeless with nothing and lost lives and pets and just irreplaceable, valuable items and things like that. It's just, I mean, there's never a good time for that kind of tragedy, but what a horrible bummer that it's during the holidays.
So
keep that in mind out there. If you're feeling generous this holiday season, keep the displaced persons of paradise, California, in mind. Also, that's so ironic. Paradise.
Yeah, right.
Jeez. Jeez. Right.
Do you guys see that clip where Trump called it pleasure?
Yep.
Two times?
No.
Twice.
No.
Yep. Twice.
Pleasure. Can you believe that name? It's called pleasure.
And then Governor Brown was like, it's fucking paradise, man. He didn't say that, but pleasure. His eyes said, it's fucking paradise.
Oh,
man.
No.
I did not.
In front of the mayor and the governor.
Yep.
Wow.
The time in which we live. The time and the place.
Okay.
Well, on that note,
went a lot of different directions.
Right? Let's shift into some holiday cheer.
Yeah, let's feel good about stuff.
Let's feel good. So if you've listened to past holiday episodes, what we tend to do for holiday episodes is just kind of like a smorgasbord of different holiday related things. We've talked about winter paintings. We've talked about like Saturnalia. Like we've talked about all kinds of stuff. So be sure to check out our other holiday episodes. I'm excited for this one. I think we have some fun topics to talk about. I suppose I'll get us started.
You're sounding so Midwest these days. I love it.
No, I just get right back into it when I'm here. Oh man, okay. So I decided to research the history of the menorah, a well-known symbol for the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. It's got a pretty interesting history. Just a little bit of a background on the holiday of Hanukkah. It commemorates the rededication of the second temple in Jerusalem at the time of the Maccabean Revolt, which was in 167 to 160 BCE. And basically, like, as the story goes, the story that's told most often is that the Maccabees only had one day's oil that lasted 8 days during the height of the revolution against Greek oppressors. And this miracle is now celebrated through the lighting of the menorah. Apparently, ancient Jewish texts do not suggest that the menorah be lit in commemoration of Hanukkah. So this is a tradition that developed actually hundreds of years after the Maccabean Revolution. Some suggest that the lighting of the menorah is actually an adaptation of pagan ritual. For example, the Zoroastrians of Persia marked the winter solstice with a festival of fire that predated Hanukkah, and it fell at about the same time of year. Similarly, it has been suggested that, like, the sages used the story of the oil lasting 8 days to kind of overtake pagan Saturnalia tradition. Mm. So it was just kind of a way to, you know, celebrate the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah that commemorates the Maccabean revolt, but then kind of fuse it with this pagan tradition. So sure. It could be celebrated in the context of Judaism. Mm-hmm.
I just want to give a quick shout out to the Rugrats for showing me everything that I know about Hanukkah.
I was thinking about that today when I was researching. I was like, all I know about Hanukkah and Passover came from the Rugrats.
Yeah, and Boris and Minka, his grandparents. Yep. I love that cartoon. Okay, all right.
I haven't seen it in so long. I would be so down to watch Rugrats.
Yes.
So, what is a menorah? So, a lot of the information I got about this was from an article by Miriam Feinberg, Vamash, and Ruth Schuster. It'll be linked on our sources on the website for you. The menorah is a widely known symbol of Jewish ceremonial art. It is a 9-armed candelabrum, which is a dope word, lit during the 8-day holiday of Hanukkah. There are 4 branches on each side, so 8 branches, to represent the 8 days of Hanukkah, and then a center stem that holds the shamash, which means helper or servant, and that is the candle that is used to light the other 8 candles. That's your typical Hanukkah menorah. The earliest Hanukkah menorahs were lamps of clay or stone with an opening on top to pour in olive oil and a small spout in the front for a wick. The thing about the menorah, the image of the menorah within Judaism in the Hanukkah menorah, is that the number of like branches or arms changed over time, and they actually kind of have different meanings. The 9-armed menorah is what's used for Hanukkah, but the 7-branched menorah, so that would be like 3 on each side and then the center, is used as a symbol of Judaism alongside the Star of David. So it's different than the Hanukkah menorah. According to the Bible, Exodus 25:31-40, to be exact, God handed down highly specific directions to Moses on Mount Sinai and I for his sanctuary and for the menorah that was to be placed inside his sanctuary. It was supposed to be made of hammered gold and have 6 branches, 3 on each side, with a central stem. So God himself wanted there to be 7, like a 7-armed menorah, which makes a lot of sense because when you think about like 7 is often associated is like the number of God. I know in Christian tradition, 7 is considered like the number of God. And then within Jewish tradition, 7 is one of the perfect numbers. I think 3 and 7 are perfect numbers according to Judaism. So yeah, it kind of makes sense that God would want the 7-armed menorah. We see 7-armed menorahs on ancient Jewish coins dating back to 40 to 37 BCE. However, it gets even more complicated because there are also many ancient depictions of a 4-branched menorah. So, once again, 2 on each side with the center branch. Mm-hmm. Let's see. There is an image. I don't know if you guys are looking at the images, but there's an image of a menorah found in an ancient drainage tunnel in Jerusalem that was carved onto a stone and dated to at least 2,000 years ago, and it only has 4 branches to it.
Like, so cute.
I know, right? It's very cute and, like, simple, but does it look like anything else to you guys? Like, do you think it could be representative of something else, or...
Well, you know what I'm thinking is those, like, little carved figures that date back to, like, the Cyclades Islands, like really, really early Mediterranean art.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of. And I think that because I just taught like a unit on that, it's just in my mind, but looks
like I get your connection there,
right?
Though. Yeah.
And like the time, like the date is, well, maybe a little bit earlier than that, but I don't know. What are you thinking, Cor?
I don't know. I just like, I mean, it's just this like cute little carving of what does look like a menorah, but also, I mean, could be, I don't know, could be like a tree. It could be a plant of some sort. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a simple figure.
Yeah.
It's hard to say for sure, I think, unless there's some other context that would, like, determine that it's a menorah. But I'm not sure. That was just kind of my first reaction when I saw it. So it has been suggested that ancient images of menorahs with 4 and 8 arms, so just to clarify, that would be 5 and 9 if you include the center arm, might actually exist because of a ban that rabbis put on images of the 7-armed candelabra.
Oh, why is that?
Because the second temple was destroyed in 70 CE, and the second temple, like, we don't have, like, no one knows what it actually looked like. Like, obviously, we don't have any remnants from it, but that is what housed the menorah that was built according to what God said he wanted. So a menorah was built and it was housed in the second temple that was destroyed in 70 CE. And so scholars believe that there may have been bans by rabbis on images of the 7-branch menorah to avoid encouraging temple practices while the great house of worship lay in ruin. So it's kind of like a, since the temple had been destroyed, it was kind of almost like a respect thing. I don't know. It was like a way of honoring or like mourning the fact that the temple was in ruin. They weren't supposed to be worshiping.
Like a long moment of silence?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah, maybe like just a really long moment of silence. So scholars say the creation of the 9-branch candelabrum that is used to celebrate Hanukkah may have been a way of just getting around the ban while still remembering the lost menorah, you know, like while still paying tribute, but like still being able to celebrate. Since there's so much variation in ancient depictions of the menorah, there is no real evidence to tell what the menorah in the second temple even really looked like, though. So that's also like kind of another wrench to throw into things. There is a relief on the Arch of Titus in Rome from 81 CE that is thought to be the oldest depiction of the menorah, right? And basically, it's an image of soldiers stealing the menorah after their triumph over the great Jewish revolt. And this image has a 7-armed menorah. Likewise, there is another image from a Herodian era mansion in Jerusalem. So this would have been during the time that the second temple was around. And it has an image of a menorah like carved into one of the walls, and it is also a 7-armed menorah. So there's, you know, a bit of evidence suggesting that would have been what the menorah looked like in the second temple. So that's kind of the background of where the menorah came from and how it started to be used in the Hanukkah tradition. Over the years, menorahs have taken on many forms and been created in pretty much every artistic style imaginable. If you want to see just like a whole array of different menorahs, you can go to thejewishmuseum.org, and they have just a huge collection dating all the way back to the 1700s, possibly even earlier. And I found a few cool menorahs that are very contemporary that I thought were interesting. The first one is by Emil Schoenfeld. It's titled College, and it was made in the 1990s. The artist has an industrial engineering background, and he created this just like very sleek, very modern traveling Hanukkah lamp that can be arranged in many different ways. It kind of looks like a, I don't know, like a puzzle or something along those lines.
It does.
It's lovely.
Like one of those brain teaser puzzles that you have to.
Yeah, and it can be arranged in different ways. And yeah, it's just very sleek and very modern. So I don't know. I thought that one was just like an interesting take on the menorah and looked a lot different than the typical image you see. Mm-hmm. And then I really love this one. This one was made in 1989 called Maquette for a Hanukkah Lamp by David Weinrib. I do too. It's made of found industrial materials, copper, steel, wood, and wax. And it was created for Temple Bethel in Spring Valley, New York. The base is like this copper plate, basically. And then you have these like windy springs that act as the candle holders. I don't know. If you saw this outside the context of a menorah, I don't know that you would think it was a menorah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just very fun and funky and once again, a modern feel, and it's all found object too, which I think is dope.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Okay, this next one, Corey, is the cutest thing I think I've ever seen.
I know, like, I love, okay, so, like, you can find, a lot of people make menorahs and sell menorahs, and you can find all kinds of cool crafted menorahs on Etsy, but I found this page, and she does more than just menorahs. She does, like, cute ceramics, but she does a lot of menorahs. Her name is Edna Piorco,
bless her,
and her Etsy name is EDNAPIO. We'll also have it linked on our sources. But she does one-of-a-kind ceramic menorahs. They are inspired by her home and landscape in North Israel. It's just, like, the cute. It's tiny. Like, I think it's technically a children's menorah. And it's just got this, like, beautiful, super cute illustration of a town. With like a, there's a little bird on a house and a little sun. And then like all the little containers for the candles are these tiny little pots, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. The interior is painted in bright colors like bright orange, blue, green, and then black. It's just like this really pleasant, adorable little menorah that I love.
I'm on her Etsy right now. And I'm freaking out because everything is so cute. And I really love the little white bird that she puts on everything. That's just, oh, yeah. I
like
love it.
And you, if you read her descriptions of the artwork, it's just super cute and pleasant and happy and like, yeah, just love her. So definitely, yeah, check out. I mean, I think a lot of her ceramics would make just great holiday gifts, anyone.
Cute.
I'm not even Jewish, but I really want one of these menorahs. So that's how cute they are.
They're pretty adorable. Is that frowned upon? Is that okay?
I don't know. Someone let us know.
You have Jewish friends.
Yeah, I know. All of my Jewish friends are like not practicing though. They're Jewish by culture, but they're not really about Hanukkah and all of that. But someone out there, if you're Jewish and you practice and you have an opinion about buying a menorah for decorative purposes, let us know if that's problematic. I don't want to be that way.
Yeah. Just in general, like, because none of us are Jewish, so, like, we don't really have, you know, a background involving Hanukkah or anything. So if any of our, you know, Jewish listeners have more insight into the history of the menorah or, like, thoughts on contemporary-looking menorahs, definitely email us. We would love to learn more.
Or if you have a cool menorah you want to show us.
Yeah, that'd be great. But yeah, that's what I got. That's what I learned today about the menorah.
Very good.
The menorah.
Very good.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
A+. Should we take a quick break?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, let's do that. We'll be right back.
We back.
Hey.
We're here.
Hope you enjoyed that message from our sponsors. That make the Art History Babes possible. We're doing our holiday extravaganza episode, and I believe it's Natalie's turn. What do you got, Nat?
So I'm going to talk about nativity scenes and kind of just the history and iconography of nativity scenes, which most people right now are probably thinking of those little dioramas that older ladies seem to have in their house often, in my experience.
Oh, yeah.
My mom has a bunch of them.
Yeah, my grandma. Definitely has a couple. Or the ones in the yard. Or the ones where people have...
Oh, yeah, the weird plastic ones with light bulbs in them.
Yeah.
Or the kids whose church make them actually do it and, like, go out and stand out there for people to look at them.
Entertainment.
Well, anyway, so traditionally these scenes in art history are titled Adoration of the Magi. And Magi is just another word for kings or wise men. I liked this. So Magi is plural. The singular is Magus.
Huh. Magus.
Or Magus. I didn't know. Is it Magus? It feels like it would be Gus if it's U.S.
Magus.
Magus? Magus?
Well, like you say magi, so magus?
Tomato.
Tomata.
Magus, magus. So this story is from the Gospel of Matthew, and basically the three wise men from the east are sent by King Herod to find, quote, the child who has been born king of the Jews. And they bring the mother and child, so Mary and baby Jesus, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. The reason that they brought these three gifts, it's thought to have lineage back to pagan traditions with like visiting temples and bringing mm-hmm. gods offerings, because gold is a precious metal, frankincense is a perfume or an incense, and myrrh is an anointing oil. So these are things that would be brought to temples of gods and left as offerings. In the text, Matthew doesn't give the names or the number of the wise men, so it's believed that there were three based on the three gifts. So people just kind of conflated three gifts to three magi, even though there's no specific number of magi ever given. Kind of piggybacking off of that, because there's no number, there's no names or like real background, but we've given them stories in different cultures, mm-hmm. but they all kind of have overlap with the Magi coming from the east. They're being sent by Herod, and basically what he wants to do is find Jesus to kill him. So they come and bring the gifts and end up deciding not to go back to Herod and let him know where the baby is, but instead to return to the east, back to their homeland, and divine intervention, call it what you will. God said, maybe don't do that. So Jesus lives on. Some kind of just interesting facts about this, like, it's very likely that the Magi came about 2 years after Jesus was born. So the timeline is often just mashed together, but in reality, there's evidence to show that, yeah, this probably happened when Jesus was about 2 years old. Mm-hmm. So the shepherds came when he was born, and that's the traditional nativity scene that we think about. And then 2 years later, Mary would have been in a home, as written in the Bible, and the Magi came to see her there and brought her the gifts then. So, visually, we have just kind of smashed it all together. It's all conflated into nativity scenes.
Right.
And there are some really interesting ones. I want to talk about Sandro Botticelli's Mystic mm-hmm. Nativity, because it's weird, and we like weird around here. And he wants to look at a very conventional nativity scene. What's it called? Mystic Nativity. It's in the doc, Google Doc, if you want to scroll to the bottom.
Oh, yeah. That's real weird.
Right?
Yeah, real weird with it.
Yeah, so it's named Mystic Nativity based on its mysterious imagery. And in the center, there is Mary in the little barn-looking structure with baby Jesus and the animals and Joseph, you know, all the huge. I think on the left we have the Magi, and on the right we have the shepherds. But there's some other things going on, like 12 angels circling the sky above them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then three angels on the ground chasing out demons. See little demons?
Oh, where are the demons?
Oh, yeah.
At the very bottom, there are little tiny demons being ran off into their little holes.
Oh, my God. Look at those little demons.
Look at the one in the bottom right. He's really cute.
I know.
He's like waving. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
He's bad. I'm going back from whence I came.
Oh.
They're bad.
Oh, that's cute.
This is actually a vision of a nativity scene from the prophecies from the revelation of Saint John. So I'll say that again because it's kind of confusing. It's a vision of a nativity scene from a prophecy from the revelation of Saint John.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. So we're all on the same page here. So the angels are all holding olive branches, and the shepherds and magi all are wearing crowns of olive branches. So peace everywhere, abundant peace. Mm. Peace be with you. Chase out the demons from the earth. And there's just so much going on. The more you look at this, the weirder it gets. Mm-hmm. You start to realize that the scale is way off. Mm-hmm. Mary is huge.
Yeah.
Like if she were to stand up in that room. And Jesus is also very, very large. Yes. He's a very big baby.
Can I just point out really quick?
Please.
Like Joseph.
Oh,
is
yeah.
In
there we go.
Shambles.
I was going to say, I was getting there, but yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
Yep. So Joseph is distraught. And his back is toward us. We can't see his face, but just body language wise, like everything is saying just like stress, which let's be real. If you were Joseph, that's how you would be feeling.
Yeah. Cause you know, he didn't have sex with Mary. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I saw a really good card recently that was like, it was like a text and it was like, Mary, this is getting ridiculous. Please tell me who you slept with or something like that.
Oh,
like,
wow. Yeah. I mean, so the story goes too that Joseph was, like crazy old, like way old, and gets with Mary and
who's very young.
They never had sex. And now all of a sudden, she gave birth to the Son of God. And then look at the size of this baby. That is a tremendous child. So I just get the sense that
is a tremendous child.
Botticelli was like, yeah, this was not an easy time for Joseph. So I like that he portrays him like that.
It's very human.
Yeah, he humanized him for sure.
I was just reading too, because looking at the scale made me think of, it's an Annunciation painting by another. It's that one where the scale is really off, but it was because it was presented at an angle. So people were only going to be able to view it from like the side. So it was intentionally made elongated.
It was in a, it was a mural, right? Like it was painted on a wall or like in an annex in a church or something.
Oh, Shiza. Oh, it's Da Vinci. It's the Da Vinci one. Yeah.
Okay. Tim.
Yeah, it's the Annunciation, which I found weirdly, like, in researching nativity art, especially from the Renaissance, kind of what gets grouped into that category isn't just the scene of Christ shortly after he's born and you have the Magi there and the shepherds. It's like the Annunciation to Mary being like, hello, you're going to have this baby. It's from God. And then there's even paintings of Joseph having a dream that he's going to have this baby via Immaculate Conception. But yes, the one I was thinking about is the Annunciation by Da Vinci. And when you look at it straight on, a lot of the angles look weird. Like Mary's arm is like a super long, like a long noodle arm. but he painted it that way because the way it was hung in a church, people were going to be like over to the left from it. So from that vantage point, it looked normal. But I think Botticelli's, it's just like he's making them big to be like, here's Mary. Here's
exactly.
Christ.
Like it's very medieval in like pictorial.
Yeah. Scale indicates importance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. So he painted this in Florence. It was completed in 1500. So this was going on around the time of Savonarola, who we have talked about on the podcast. Go back and listen to our Smashin' and Slashin' episode. Oh my. To learn more about him.
A crazy dude.
Crazy man.
You know those people that you just want to travel back in time and be like, you're fucking nuts. Stop it.
Stop.
He's one of them.
Just stop.
Him and like the Puritans.
Of someone just like using a time machine to go back to these different people and just being like, no.
Stop it. History will look upon you with shame.
Excuse me, I am from the future. Stop it.
I know what I'm talking about.
Enough. Yeah, so as he's painting this, Florentine painters are veering a little toward the natural, trying to represent nature in a very one-to-one way, trying to skirt around the word realistic here. Can you catch that, guys? and Botticelli was openly talking about this idea of artificiality in art. And he signed this painting at the top with the inscription, I, Sandro, made this picture at the conclusion of the year 1500 in the troubles of Italy in the half-time after the time, according to the 11th chapter of St. John in the second woe of the apocalypse, during the loosing of the devil for 3.5 years, and then he will be chained in the 12th chapter, and we shall see as in this picture.
Wow.
Sandro was having, like, a end-of-life crisis, I'd say.
Yeah. What does it even mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
It's a lot of ofs.
Right.
Which we know from grad school is just not great writing style.
Exactly. Mm. It's very passive.
A little worry.
It's passive worry.
But yeah, so this was just a weird time in Florence and created this really weird nativity scene for us.
Interesting.
And I think, I don't know, we can kind of relate to apocalyptic feelings and
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, I listened to that entire podcast, by the way. Josh Clark's The End of the World.
Oh.
And it's
Oh yeah.
It scared me a lot.
I can't do apocalyptic it's stuff intense. Anymore.
Yeah, I now bet. That I know all about existential threats, I'm just like, cool, I should just never have a child because
right?
there's not going to be a world for them to live in.
Right.
Ugh.
Anyways, going to bring it back around. Happy holidays,
Julie. Yeah. That's what we're talking about.
We're happy.
Did you have anything else, Nat?
Nope, or that was it. That... One weird nativity scene for you all.
That's great.
And so, if you want to see some plain ones, just Google.
Oh, there's
thousands of more simple of ones. But
go for a drive through the suburbs, I'm sure.
Oh,
you'll,
God, yeah.
You'll see one or two.
And maybe take your time and stop and let them know that technically that is chronologically incorrect and that those scenes happen at different times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they'll appreciate it.
They'll love it.
They'll be like, get off my lawn, you weirdo.
So next, are we going to talk about Santa Claus?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Santa Claus.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Old Saint Nick. We've all heard him referred to as such. And so the name Santa Claus has its roots in the informal Dutch name for Saint Nicholas. Sinterklaas. It's an abbreviation.
One more time.
Sinterklaas. So that's an abbreviation of Sint Nicholas, which is Dutch for Saint Nicholas. Saint Nicholas was a historic 4th century Greek saint from an area now in modern day Turkey. So Asia Minor, one of those places that has become many different places over the years, but now True. We think of it as Turkey. And Saint Nicholas had a reputation for secret gift giving. Not a lot is known about the man himself, but a lot of the information that we have about him revolves around his gift giving. So he was supposedly born into a very wealthy Christian family. And so he would do things like put coins in shoes that people would leave out for him. There's a very famous story about the historical Saint Nicholas, who was said to have rescued 3 girls from being forced into prostitution by dropping a sack of gold coins through the window of their house each night for 3 nights so their father could pay a dowry for each of them. So that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good on you, Saint Nick. Other stories tell him doing things like calming a storm at sea or
sure.
saving innocent soldiers from
quite the range.
Wrongful yeah. execution.
Yeah.
There's a story that he chopped down a tree possessed by a demon.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wait, I'm going to need to read that one.
He did a lot
wow.
of stuff. Right.
What a
and
life
so,
this man
he's
led.
He's an interesting kind of dude. And so where we are now is how did this kindly Christian saint become the roly-poly, red-suited American symbol for merry holiday festivity yeah, and commercial activity. The story really starts with the first Europeans to arrive in the New World. They brought Saint Nicholas with them, and so Vikings were said to have dedicated a cathedral to him in Greenland, and then even Columbus, on his first voyage, supposedly named a Haitian port for Saint Nicholas on December 6, 1492, the infamous year where everything went to hell after.
Yes.
In Florida, Spaniards named an early settlement St. Nicholas Ferry, which is now known as Jacksonville.
Cool. Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
Oh, man. In the 16th century, St. Nicholas had a difficult time because of the Protestant Reformation, mm-hmm. which took a dim view of saints. Mm-hmm. And even though both reformers and counter-reformers tried to stamp out St. Nicholas-related customs, they had very little success, except in England, where religious folk traditions were permanently altered. But other than England, it seems that St. Nick was so beloved that he survived on the European continent as well as in the New World. People continued to place nuts, apples and sweets and shoes left besides beds and windowsills or before the hearth. So this whole tradition of leaving things out for Santa Claus dates way, way back. Eventually that evolves into he comes down the chimney.
Yeah.
He was the patron saint of children, so he was associated with giving gifts to children.
Definitely his love language.
Yeah. Aw, lovely. I love love languages. So in his Dutch form of Sinterklaas, he was imagined to carry a staff.
I feel like your pronunciation gets more and more ridiculous. Like, Sinterklaas!
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
So there's an evolution. There's this idea that St. Nicholas might have been conflated with pagan imagery of Odin. And in the Dutch tradition, there's imagery of him having carried a staff riding above the rooftops on a huge white horse. Odin rode a white horse that had 8 legs. So that is
that
interesting.
Looks really good.
Right.
Really
and eventually that normal. Translates into the reindeer that we know him to lead his sleigh today.
Wild.
Yeah. You know, and this is Germanic peoples in North and Western Europe prior to Christianization. So all this is kind of happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes sense. In Europe, the Feast of St. Nicholas was typically on the 6th of December, and this was very popular throughout the Middle Ages. After the Reformation in the 16th century, the celebration died out in most Protestant countries, apart from Holland, where they still celebrate Sinterklaas on December 6th.
Of course they do.
Very cool. So in the 17th century, the image of Santa Claus becomes conflated with this phenomenon of Father Christmas, which Ginny's going to talk more about. Mm-hmm. Old Father Christmas, also known as Sir Christmas or Lord Christmas. It's pretty cool.
Lord Christmas.
This is where we start to get the image of Santa Claus as a bearded old man, and he's typically represented as the spirit of good cheer at Christmas, but in this case isn't associated with children or bringing gifts. And so the earliest English examples of the personification of Christmas are thought to be from the 15th century carol referring to Sire Christmas. Let's move on to the 1800s. So East Coast of America is suddenly full of Dutch settlers, and they brought Sinterklaas with them.
Of course
and
they did.
He made his way throughout the East Coast of the United States, and so this gave birth to the Americanized Santa Claus. In 1804, a man named John Pintard, who was an influential patriot and antiquarian, founded the New York Historical Society and promoted St. Nicholas as patron saint of both the society and the city.
Wow.
And so on December 6, 1810, they had their first St. Nicholas anniversary dinner. And so St. Nicholas becomes a staple of this Eastern Dutch community.
Mm-hmm.
So St. Nicholas Day never really took off in the way that Pintard wanted, but a print made by Alexander Anderson, which was commissioned by John Pintard, got very popular. And so his image of Sankt Claus became one of the earliest images of Santa Claus in the United States. And so more conflation of Odin-like elements from German and Norse legends create this sleigh-riding saint who, at this point in time, he no longer has the crazy 8-legged horse. Now he has flying reindeer. And it's just
very
starting
natural.
A lot of stuff's going on at this time. There's like satirical fiction happening in New York that describes a jolly Saint Nick flying with reindeer in a sleigh, delivering presents down chimneys. And so during this time, more and more is added to the Santa Claus legend. In 1863, the cartoonist Thomas Nast established the bounds for Santa Claus's current look. So there's an issue of Harper's Weekly that shows Santa Claus, who is wearing this like really cool cloak with little stars on it, and he is shown giving out toys. His drawings become part of a book that shows his workshop and the names of children who've been naughty or nice. So all this imagery is coming together in the late 19th century. And so over the years, Santa Claus would start to be depicted in a variety of colors, blue, green, yellow, as he is shown in an 1864 edition of a book by Clement Moore called A Visit from St. Nicholas.
He is real cute.
Isn't he so cute? He's just wearing
like,
all
what
yellow.
What a cute little St. Nicholas he is.
It's like a gnome.
Yeah.
There's a sugar plum in 1868 that puts a red jacket on Santa Claus. His hat is green. And he's not wearing
pants.
He's
a little lit.
he's lit. He forgot to put pants on. That's great.
Pants.
Thomas Nast would go on to make Merry Old Santa. And this is really the modern Santa character. Mm. He is jolly. He is rotund. He wears the red suit. He's really looking like your modern day Santa Claus. And so a lot of artists give their take on Santa Claus around the turn of the century. L. Frank Baum, who was the author of The Wizard of Oz, came out with The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus, and shows his book really gives us this pretty cemented image of Santa Claus by this point. And I've got the link here, but if you click on this link that we'll post in our sources, you can flip through this lovely little book and just look, it's just some cute stuff, just some cute Santas. By like 1913, you know, Norman Rockwell, who we know to be just the quintessential kind of Americana guy in the early 1900s, he just really cements this image of Santa Claus and starts to even include Santa in images that are later used for like war propaganda. So like World War One, there's Santa Claus is shown.
That's weird.
Yeah, with like the U.S., like the FDA. Is this the FDA? The U.S. Food Administration, probably early FDA. It's a poster from the Office for Emergency Management, circa 1942, says Santa Claus has gone to war and he's holding a gun and he has a helmet on and it says your gift. Plenty of weapons, the inland way for USA. So Santa just becomes a very multi-faceted figure. And so at this point, like World War II, we have our traditional Santa Claus. So he's been through a wild ride from Dutch
Sinterklaas
to gun-toting World War II propaganda Santa. So anyway.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
That's what I have for us today.
Oh, my.
And
that was great. That was a very succinct,
I learned a
nice,
lot
like,
about Santa.
So the whole life of
Yeah, I kind of wish that he had stayed at the eight-legged white horse that flies through the air.
Bring it back.
I know.
So does Santa have eight reindeer?
I think he does have eight reindeer.
Or is it 12?
Is it eight?
I think it's eight. On Prancer, on Dancer, on...
Yeah.
I'm going to be really impressed if you can remember that.
Is it...
How many reindeer?
Blitz and...
Here, I'm looking it up.
Between Ginny and we got at least
eight.
Four.
It's eight.
The history of Santa Claus is super fascinating. I mean, I think even in like a future holiday episode, we could maybe, you know, go deeper into some of these images because there's just like so much and so much to look at. And like...
So much of it is rooted in old world Dutch... traditions and
I had no
idea. And,
yeah,
and that is really cool. Like even the names of the eight reindeer, Blixen, it was originally spelled Blixum and we changed it to Blitzen. The other names like Dunder and Blixen
that's hella Dutch.
Derive from the Dutch words for thunder and lightning.
Oh, those are cute names.
Yeah. Very fun. Okay.
Let's take another quick break, and then we'll come back and wrap things up with Ginny.
I'm going to pee. Yes.
We're back. All right. We have returned.
So John Leech, who was a Victorian British illustrator who did the illustrations for Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And, you know, Christmas Carol is still Christmas as fuck.
Yeah.
A Christmas Carol is legitimately my favorite story of all time. Like, I love that story. Muppet Christmas Carol is my favorite movie.
Before we connect into A Christmas Carol, because if you're like me, I knew nothing about John Leech before I was like, oh, who illustrated the first publication of Christmas Carol? John Leech was a caricaturist and illustrator. He was born in 1817. I think he's really fundamental in kind of developing this Victorian Christmas aesthetic and visual culture that still like reigns supreme today. Like the Bay Area has like the Dickens Fair every Christmas, which is a real treat if you want to go. It feels like you're walking through Victorian London, but it's in a warehouse.
Oh, wow.
And then people dress up. Oh. And then they have like roasted chestnuts.
That sounds so much fun. I want to go.
The one in the city is coming up. The one in San Francisco is coming up. Anyways, so John Leech, part of this visual culture tradition, but he originally went to study medicine, but his family went bankrupt, which is like a very Victorian thing to me. I'm like, oh yes, the family went bankrupt. You need to leave your dreams behind and save the family. So he had to find a job, and he was a pretty talented anatomical drawer. So he was like, oh, be an artist. If only it were that easy now. So he became an artist, and he had friends in the illustration and caricature business, which helped, certainly. So his early works were satirical lithographs, and then he moved on to wood engraving, which was having a resurgence in popularity in 19th century London. He began working at the satire and comedy magazine called Punch. So contemporary.
That is.
Right?
Are they still around?
Maybe.
I was kind of kidding.
I mean, maybe he loves its old shit, so
it's true.
It's very
if someone's going to hold on to it.
It's going to be them. He really becomes like the guy of Victorian pictorial satire. So like he was doing political satire. It was very in vogue at the time to hate Americans because the revolution was still pretty fresh. Mm. It was also in vogue to be an anti-Semite, you know? So he definitely like fed into those trends, but he was very, very, very popular in Victorian England. And so he worked mainly with engravings. And meanwhile, Charles Dickens is working on finishing up A Christmas Carol. And Dickens at the time, he was like in his early 30s, like 30 or 31, and he was in debt. And this story was really kind of like his Hail Mary, where he was like, if this doesn't work, I'm fucked. And he was like, I need an illustrator. It's going to make this book. And I want like the top guy. And at that time, it was John Leech. And his publishers initially were a little hesitant. They were like, I don't know if that's going to save this. Like, they really didn't have that much hope at the time in A Christmas Carol and it actually being like a really commercial success. But Dickens got John Leech anyways. And obviously, A Christmas Carol became a huge, huge, huge success. And it's really interesting because the first publication of A Christmas Carol came out in 1843, and the book was pretty small, like it could fit in one hand. So the illustrations were like that much more evocative and integral to the story because, you know, you're like holding this story in like the palm of your hand, and you can just get really that much closer to these engravings, which were really richly detailed. So what I think is most striking about A Christmas Carol is that it really had such a huge role in kind of putting more of what modern Western cultures consider like the spirit of Christmas and how you're supposed to act around Christmas and kind of these traditions and, you know, like the Scrooge working on Christmas Day. And actually after, interesting fact, after A Christmas Carol was first published, it didn't used to be a bank holiday on Christmas, but after A Christmas Carol it was.
Whoa.
Yeah. So he did 8 total. They were wood engravings. And like, if you don't know a lot about wood engravings, they're really hard to do. I mean, all printmaking is very technical and difficult. Like, take a printmaking class and you're like, oh my God. It's just, there's so many layers to it. And it takes a lot of like really in-depth skill and patience to do. But wood engraving in particular you're carving into wood, and oftentimes it's so like if you cut like a branch down, you're not using the round side, you're using the flatter side, so it's harder and tighter grain. So it really does require quite a bit of skill to be able to carve precise lines into that, and sometimes you'll have to do multiple layers of it. So he did 8 total, and they're just like lovely, fun little illustrations that I really do think are still kind of what a lot of people have in mind when they're visualizing Christmas. You know, like you have these like ballroom dances where, you know, the people are around and there's mistletoe mm-hmm. and holly. And in particular, I want to talk about John Leech's engraving for the Ghost of Christmas Present, the main character of Ebenezer Scrooge, who's like, if you've ever heard the expression like, oh, don't be a Scrooge. He's like a total downer, just grumpy, mean man. And he's visited by various spirits, and it jumps across different temporal periods. And the overarching story is to be kind around Christmas, but also just in your life in general. So he is visited by first the ghost of his dead business partner, who warns him about living life as like a very greedy person. And that ghost has chains, like, and so he's like chained by his greed, which I'm not sure. I would have to double check this, but you know that kind of like visual we have of ghosts and chains? I think it came from this.
From this? Yeah.
Yeah, so like you have that kind of like very dark definitely. Imagery, but then you also have a lot of imagery of like hope and joy and sort of seasonal cheer. And the biggest example of that is the Ghost of Christmas Present. And really with this, I think that Dickens created like a new brand of seasonal cheer. And Leech's work helped to visually solidify those messages. And especially this sort of blending of fantasy and Christmas mm-hmm. is particularly interesting to look at from the perspective of the 19th century, because like around this time was when the Brothers Grimm's fairy tales were translated. So they were hugely popular in England in the 19th century. And so like building off of that tremendous popularity of fairy tales and like fantasy, and then finding a way to like combine those like Dickens did, was at the time like a pretty novel thing to do. And it made somewhat of a challenge for an artist who had to represent both fantasy and reality mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So the way that Leech did that is pretty fun. I like it. So looking at the Ghost of Christmas Present, you have a kind of like giant man, especially compared to Scrooge, who's just like this little, this like little like elfin looking man. Mm-hmm. And he's much smaller in scale, obviously. And the Ghost of Christmas Present is in this like beautiful, like deep green robe, bare chested, like carrying a torch.
Is he kind of hot?
Yeah, he's a little bit of a babe.
I think he is.
He's like a bear babe.
Like he's not bad. You know?
I mean, their faces are a little distorted, so it's hard to tell.
Right.
But his hair looks lush.
Mm. He's got rosy cheeks.
Mm-hmm. A little hair on his chest. Like, he's got a little smirk.
Mm-hmm.
He really looks like he is ready to party.
Yeah. He does.
Yeah.
He looks like a frat star at, like, a holiday frat party.
You guys need to Google the Ghost of Christmas Present from the Muppet Christmas Carol really quick.
Present. Muppet.
Oh, look at him.
Look at this guy.
He looks like Hagrid.
Oh, he does.
Isn't he the best?
He really does.
Oh, so jovial.
But yeah, I mean, and even in these, like the example of the Muppet, like he has red hair. And then when you watch, like, you know, those old claymation Christmas movies, mm-hmm. there's one about Santa Claus as a young man and they make him a redhead. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't know where that comes mm-hmm. from either. There's so many layers of symbolism. But like looking at this illustration, I get that later connection
right?
to, or not even that much later, but how we visualize Santa Claus now, I get the connection with this. And how this also is drawing from some like pagan images. Cause like he almost reminds me of like a Bacchus mm-hmm. in this illustration. You know, he's like
yes, definitely.
Lording over, you know, this feast. And looks very jovial. like you would just have a great time with him, mm-hmm. and how he is in this story and also in this illustration serves to embody the Christmas spirit, where it's about being joyful and giving and spending time with family and friends and being around food and like in the home by the hearth. This was like very, very instrumental, I think, in creating that visual narrative of Christmas. We're going to post a link so that you can see all of them. So like I said, four of them were hand colored and four of them are just as they are wood engraving. So there's no color added to them, but it's really interesting how Leach approached representing these like spirits and sort of fantastical figures. I read a really interesting article called Text Dropped into the Woodcuts, Dickens Christmas Books by Sarah Solberg. And she says that Leach designed his spirits in such a manner that they do not appear to be as solid as his characters of flesh and blood. So like if you look at the print of Marley's ghost or some of the black and white images, you can see that these sort of mm-hmm. figures are, they're depicted in either like more dull color or in the black and white versions, they're just done with finer lines so that they look a little bit more translucent.
Yeah.
And at the time that was like a big deal because depicting like ghosts and shit in art wasn't really as popular. Like I talked about earlier, the original publication of A Christmas Carol was this small book. It was a green cover and it had like this beautiful like gold embossed lettering and it had holly ornamentation. So it was very just like seasonal and cheerful, and how that format of the book made these illustrations that more interactive. And the engravings without color were dropped to the bottom of the page. No text below and maybe like 5 to 8 lines above, but the engravings with color got a full page. And in some cases, like Leach got kind of, he did these almost like bubbles, illustration bubbles. So they weren't gridded at all or framed really, like they're just these sort of like soft looking holes that you see. And I just love the one from the frontispiece of the book, which is Mr. Fezziwig's ball. And they're wow. just like these little round, pudgy, rosy cheeked British people.
This kid on the left is creeping me out.
On the left, just ruining things.
He's not having a good time.
Yeah, he's like 13. He just wants to go home and masturbate. That's all he wants to do. But yeah, they're really, I think they're very fun illustrations, and Dickens is often credited with, or perhaps, credited, I guess is the best word, for coming up with the Christian Christmas iconography in like the more early modern sense. And as we've talked about many times in this podcast, like it's well enough to do that via text, but you also need some imagery, like really solidify that shit. And I think that John Leach tremendously impacted that effect that A Christmas Carol, how we visualize the characters from A Christmas Carol still to this day. So there we are. There you go. Oh, hello.
I love those little images. Ugh.
They're really fun.
So fun.
If I were like a very wealthy person and a book collector, I'd be like, give me that first publication.
Yeah,
because I would, it just sounds like it was a really lovely overall package.
I was looking up like if I could find just like a newer but like cool version of it, mm-hmm. and I found one, but then I went and looked at the reviews, and apparently the editor, publisher, whatever, mm-hmm. put in an introduction that's like very conservative and like kind of homophobic and transphobic.
What?
Why?
So don't buy that one.
How?
I know. I like had it in my cart because it was like $10 and then nope.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's why you always read the reviews.
I know.
It's true.
Angry people just like to have a platform to be angry.
So true.
Oh, man. Well, that's a bummer. Let's forget about that. And
just look at these illustrations, okay? Don't be like Scrooge. Don't let the ghost of Christmas yet to come show you your own grave because you're being a dick.
So before we wrap this up, moving forward, because obviously we get things wrong sometimes. This may come as a shock, but we occasionally get things wrong. And so I think just like moving forward, we're going to kind of use the end of episodes to both read listener mail and to give any like corrections we may have gotten on past information. And one correction involves the conspiracy theories episode we did forever ago. In that episode, I told a story basically secondhand. It wasn't even from my own research about how a friend of mine told me that they had read that the memory that a lot of people have of the Challenger explosion is like a false memory. And that it isn't a real memory that a lot of people have, but we got emails from two different people, both nice, like they weren't mad or anything, like, but we just got emails from two different people that were like, hey, I actually do remember watching that in school. So I don't know. I don't know if maybe it's a false memory to some extent for some people, and there were other schools that did show the Challenger explosion.
Yeah.
There are people that do remember watching the Challenger explosion, and yeah, we appreciate you writing in. My information was purely anecdotal, so I have no research to back it up whatsoever. So yeah, thank you for writing in. We appreciate it. Likewise, if we said anything else anywhere on the podcast and you think it might be incorrect, please write us.
We hope everyone has a lovely holiday season, a happy Christmas, a happy Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever you celebrate. You know, don't feel, if you don't want to be around your family because they cause you great mental distress, don't go. Do your own thing. Leave out your shoes with some nuts and berries for Sinterklaas.
And he will give you coin.
Oh, man.
I wish. I'll put my shoes out with nuts in them tonight because I need coin.
I need someone to pay my dowry.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for listening to our Holiday Magic 2018 episode. We love you guys. You're the best.
We love you very much. Echoing back to Nat's original statement, be good to each other.
Mm-hmm. Word.
All right. Love you guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Love you.
Love you. Bye.
From Cabernet to Moulin, to hear this lady art history bay.
Savonarola.
God, that guy.
That fucking guy.
Jesus. Jesus.
I had a nightmare about him once, like, for real. Yeah, in undergrad.
Terrifying.
We were learning about him, and then I had the flu, so I was having, like, fever dreams. Oof.